Hello, and welcome to episode 90 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
If you aren't sure that nearly everything has become political, let's talk for a moment about our yards. It used to be that some homeowners paid great attention to having a perfectly manicured lawn, while others took a more casual approach. But, and pardon the pun, a growing trend across many cities is No Mow May, an initiative that encourages people to leave their lawns untouched so pollinators and other small critters can flourish. And those homeowners who have perfectly green and weed-free lawns now sometimes get the side eye from people who are worried about environmental impact of perfectly manicured grass. Rick, is it ethical to judge others simply on how they care for and maintain their yards?
Absolutely. This is my rule about judgment. If you can judge yourself, you can judge others.
Okay.
Right? So, and we judge ourselves all the time. Whenever we say that, this is something I shouldn't have been doing, so I'm going to stop doing it now. We're judging ourselves, and that carries with it an implicit judgment of others who are not changing their behavior, right?
Absolutely.
But what you should remember is that you're judging people's behavior, not their character, right?
That's an interesting point, actually. Mm-hmm. Maybe tease that out a little more.
Well, because we judge our own behavior all the time. Whenever you change your behavior, or if you're reaffirmed in something you've been doing, you're making a judgment about it. You're telling yourself that this is what I should do. And so then you're naturally judging others in a way. So like, if they're similarly placed, that's something that they should do too.
But that doesn't, like you said, make them an awful person if they choose something with which you may disagree.
No, not it. And especially if you're thinking about yourself, like I didn't think that yesterday I was a bad person just because I changed my mind about something and decided to do it different. So if you decide you're going to participate in No Mow May because you're convinced it's better for pollinators and say you didn't do it last year, but now you're going to do it because you researched it or something, or some friends have convinced you it's a good thing to do, that implies a judgment about what you did last year, that it wasn't the best for pollinators. And it implies that if your neighbors are mowing, you think they're not doing something that's the best for pollinators, but you don't think you were an evil person last year, and you shouldn't think that your neighbors are either, right?
So we both live, what, a mile and a half apart, probably?
Yep.
We both have yards.
Yeah.
Are you participating in our city's No Mow May program, which, to explain for those who may not be familiar, again, is a program that's becoming more and more popular in municipalities across this country, where, especially maybe in the northern climates, but maybe in other parts of the country too, where nature's just sort of waking up and you have lots of critters and pollinators who might need a little more time to flourish and thrive and enjoy the extra dandelions and grass that an unmowed May yard might provide. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah.
So what are your personal, what are you doing this May? What are you doing for No Mow May this year, Rick?
Pretty much the same thing we've always done with our yard, which is not apply any herbicides or pesticides. So we have a lot of dandelions. We have other kinds of things besides the regular, you know, bluegrass or fescue or whatever we have planted. We have varieties of grass planted. We usually mow it at the highest setting of the mower, mm-hmm. and we mow rather infrequently.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to be as friendly as we can to a variety of insects, which is also better for birds and other
yep.
things. I find the No Mow May thing kind of silly because, well, we can get into all the reasons I don't think it's very good, but I think it's kind of silly the way our city does it, is it wants you to register and
yes.
get a sign to do something that they're trying to promote. So like, I guess conceivably, you could get a citation for not mowing your lawn if you don't register and get a sign, but they don't want you to mow your lawn. So are they giving you citations for doing something they don't want you to do? Right? Like,
yeah, I don't, again, every city may run this differently, but I do, I mean, if I ran our city, I would just simply say, you know, maybe thinking about not mowing your yard in May is a good idea. And in fact, it's such a good idea that we won't start enforcing the weed and tall grass ordinance until June rolls around. So if for those who choose to do this, that's great. And we'll even maybe put a page on our website explaining why it's great. And if you choose not to, well, thank goodness we still live in a free world and you can mow every day if you want.
Yeah.
But I just think that you're right. It seems a little performative to make people go out and register, and then they can bring a sign back and place the sign out in their yard and say, oh, look at me, I care about the earth, and I'm going to not mow this month. And I just think that whole thing seems a little silly, and maybe those extra few steps convince some people that it's just not worth that much work.
I think it's great to bring more attention to the needs of pollinators, because we really have had a decline in pollinators, you know, over the last 50 years or so. So that's great that we're doing that. And it's interesting how lots of times people don't really pay attention to something until there's some pressure from peers. So like there's some social norming that takes place to get people to change their behaviors, and that's what we're trying to get people to do. And yet, it's not really a very effective way of doing it. I mean, like having everybody just not mow their grass for a whole month is not necessarily the best way to help pollinators if you're not doing some regular changes to your landscaping for the whole summer.
What I was, I took a moment to look up. When I was a kid growing up in the probably late 70s, early 80s, my father cared about his yard a lot, and we had a very well manicured lawn, and he mowed it regularly and weeded it and all the things people like to do. And we had a company, this is what I was just checking to see if this company's still around, and it was acquired and there was a name change, so the short answer is not really. But a company, and I don't know if this was regional or national, called ChemLawn.
Yeah.
And you're familiar with ChemLawn.
Yep, so. Yep.
And now, I mean, if you were today going to create a company that was going to say to folks, you know, maybe your yard doesn't look so great, we're going to come over and make it look better, and you said, well, I have the name, how about ChemLawn? You would be like laughed out of the room today, right?
Yeah.
But that was like a thing, and it was probably popular in 30, 40 years ago.
Well, and it's lasted quite a while. I don't know if it's still the name, but there's other, like, True Green is a big company.
That's right another now, one, but right? At least because, that's that you aren't going to get laughed out of the room with that name.
Yeah, yeah, it's a much better name. But, I mean, the studies about how much, like, pesticide and herbicide residue enter into your home.
Yes.
And are just in your carpets and it contaminate your air.
Especially if you have kids and pets.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. I mean, that alone is an idea, just the health concerns are reason enough to be really cautious about the use of those, especially if it's a lawn where you're regularly walking through. If you're just looking at it, that's one thing. But if you're walking through it, or if you have kids or pets that are going through it all the time, you don't want to apply anything that's toxic. You know, that is a real health concern. And especially if you have no idea what it is that people are applying, I mean, I would think it's better not to put it on there. But I know that we've never used herbicides and pesticides, which means that, you know, we have a lot of dandelions. My wife doesn't mind going out and pulling dandelions by hand, fortunately, because I don't care for doing it, but we have a lot anyway, because it's hard to keep up with them. But you know, we have a fairly small lawn, and I've noticed that we have a ton of birds.
Yeah.
Around our lawn and you know, robins pulling out worms and eating other insects and so forth that you don't always see in many of the more nicely manicured lawns.
See, I'm facing a decision here soon because we have I haven't fertilized in years. Our yards are at best average, but the backyard, and this started last year and it's now, you know, significantly into spring, and I don't know what happened back there, but like, the majority of the backyard looks like it's like either near death or dead. And like, I don't know what's happening. And a neighbor actually said, and I did not know this, that in our, and I'm sure this varies from place to place, but in our community, if you get a cup or two and put it in a Ziploc bag, the county has a program where they will analyze it for you and tell you what your, what the problem with the soil might be. So I will do that and make it like cost $20. So I'll do that just because I'm curious.
Yeah.
So I'll do that. But like, let's say that comes back and says, you have a deficiency in X. Well, I mean, so then I have to decide, and maybe it's something that's not, I would have to do some research, and I'm about the least expert on this process, but like, I'm going to be kind of wary if it means like putting a whole bunch of chemicals on my yard to like make my grass come back. But at the same time, I don't want to be like the one guy in the block who has like this terrible looking backyard. So like, I just don't know how this will play out this summer. And again, there are worse things happening in the world than this exact dilemma, but it is something that, you know, I'm like, I'm just not sure what I'm going to learn from this.
Well, one of the problems we have that's creating the dead zone down in, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. and we're right on the upper Mississippi River.
Yep.
So a lot of the, you know, nitrates and phosphates and things that enter into the Mississippi River and end up creating the dead zone are coming off of both lawns and farm fields in the upper Midwest here. The problem with on lawns anyway, is people overapply them. And so then they end up not going into the soil and provide nutrients. They end up running off during a hard rain, entering into the storm sewer and then down in the river. So there's nothing wrong with putting some fertilizer on your lawn in modest amounts to regenerate soil health. Along with aeration and other things that it needs, right? And then planting some grass. What I disagree with is the use of especially pesticides and herbicides on grass just to make it look nicer when it's not so good for the health of the insect population, which you want in your yard.
You know, I remember hearing somebody talk about years ago. And I don't know if we've moved the dial on this much, but somebody years ago on TV was saying, as we became more and more aware of the dangers that, you know, tanning beds and the sun does on people's skin, they said, geez, you know, there has been so long people thought that a healthy person was a tan person that sort of had an aura of health and well-being around them. And, you know, in effect, that's probably not true, and that, you know, a healthy person probably isn't having in the summertime a deep, deep, dark tan for reasons we now all understand. And I wonder if we're getting to that same point with lawns, that we used to think that the perfect lawn was maybe the one my father wanted, you know, 40 years ago growing up in our neighborhood. Do you think, though, that we have really turned a corner, that seeing a yard like yours, at least, which is maybe has some weeds and has some dandelions and also has a lot of birds and other little critters. Do you think now maybe at least some people say, geez, that's actually the kind of lawn you want, not the guy down the street who barely has a blade of grass out of place?
I think the aesthetic sensibility is changing along with more kind of consciousness about the ecological harm of certain kinds of both overapplication of fertilizer and herbicides and pesticides. So I think that is changing somewhat, and that's understandable. I mean, you know, lawns are a kind of a temporary phenomenon. They, you know, they were something that develops from the aristocracy in England and France in the 1700s.
Where they had staff to take care of that.
Yeah, because those were all hand-trimmed lawns. And so having a big lawn was a kind of a social statement, a wealth statement.
Status symbol.
In the United States, it really comes from Jefferson and Washington, who had slaves that would take care of their properties. And they brought in, you know, ideas about landscape architecture from Europe. And that wasn't really achievable for anybody. If you look at old paintings by Homer Winslow and, you know, and others that show these domestic scenes from the early 1800s, you don't see manicured lawns in most places. What you see a lot more dirt. You see wildflowers. You see, you know, tall grasses and different things, but you don't see these manicured large lawns. What you get is like in the mid-1800s, the invention of the lawnmower. Mm. And that makes possible this kind of aristocratic ideal for the masses. And then you get the explosion of suburbs in the 1950s, in the post-World War II era. So you get a lot more wealth, aspirations for a kind of living a lifestyle with certain kinds of ideas of wealth. And one of them is a large lawn. And I remember, so like my grandparents bought a place out on a lake. It was like the first place they had of their own. They had renting houses for a long time. They bought this little house that they fixed up on a lake. Well, his neighbor had a huge lawn that he mowed with his riding lawnmower, but he also mowed the ditches on the road near his house. And then on the opposite side of the road, there was a ditch that he mowed that went up to a barbed wire fence that was a pasture where cows were grazing. So he had this large green lawn and both ditches, which he didn't own, right? Because you don't own the ditches, but he's mowed them and planted grass and the whole thing is beautiful. So my grandfather decided he needs to do the same thing to keep up with the neighbor and have, so like he, you know, has this old push lawnmower and I'm 10, 11 years old and he's going to pay me a dollar or something to mow this ditch, which is, you know, it's 3 feet of wild, you know, plants that are growing in there. I mow the whole ditch. It takes me all day. It was a miserable experience. The next day, I break out in poison ivy.
Oh, no.
On both legs from the bottom of my shorts down, you know, to my ankles. And I had bumps and blisters like a half inch deep all the way around my legs. It was like for weeks I suffered from it. And it's the last time my grandfather ever asked me to mow his. He gave up on that aspiration. And I tell you what, I've had a negative attitude about large lawns ever since. I mean, I just like why have we fallen in love with that idea? Because they're sterile. They're ecologically sterile.
And I would say, unfortunately, but you know, you see fewer kids and families spending time. I mean, I get, so to me, lawns are defensible in a way if, you know, you're always out there and playing games or using it as rec space, great. But if
And I like having a certain amount of lawn for that reason. So if you have a purpose for a lawn, so kids are out playing or you're like, there's lots of reasons. You like to play croquet, whatever it is. Like there's lots of reasons to have lawn as a gathering place and, you know, and so forth. I love that. But you should pay attention. I think Nomo May, at least it's drawn attention to the needs of pollinators. And so there's a few things you can do, like plants, have some corners, some areas in your yard with plants that are good for pollinators that flower at different times of the summer. Mm-hmm. So as the different bee species, they come out of hibernation at different times of the year. You know, summer in April and then May and June and July, there's something there for them at different times. That's a really great idea, and that's actually more effective than No Mow May.
Yeah.
Some people have been promoting something they call Slow Mow Summer, and I kind of like that idea better. It's not quite as catchy.
But if I understand it, it basically is what I think should be everybody's approach, is to be lazy about lawn care. Is that really what it is?
Yeah, I'm just trying to justify the fact that I don't like to do lawn.
Well, no, I see. I'm 100% in on lazy lawn care. I mean, obviously you don't want to have something that's embarrassing, probably. But like beyond that, I think a lazy approach to lawn care suits me just fine.
Well, and it's actually healthy for your lawn to let it grow longer because then you get deeper roots and it's going to survive periods without rain better, right? But I. From what I gather, the rule is you should be cutting no more than a third of the height of your grass. And so you really don't want to let it grow up to, you know, 10 or 12 inches and then it cut it down to two. Like, that's not, that's hard on your grass.
Well, and you mentioned people planting pollinator gardens or plants that attract pollinators. That's great. But another thing that that kind of had a little moment during the pandemic was people sort of re-embracing vegetable gardens. And I think there is still some of that going on. And I will admit that's something I have like less than zero interest in, but I think it's great for those who do.
Yeah.
Do you grow vegetables?
We really don't have a spot. We've got a corner lot. So we've got, you know, a little bit of grass kind of all the way around the house, but we don't have a nice sunny spot for a garden, which is kind of unfortunate. So my wife grows a few tomatoes in pots that she can move, but she has to move them around.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we grow some that are on our porch. But, you know, a few, I think she grows some different kinds of cilantro or, you know, a few plants like that. But just for the most part, we have to do, you know, just a few shade-tolerant plants.
And you touched on your not-so-great experience with lawn mowing the ditch, but that's just another thing that sort of is hitting the culture wars, if you will, or the lawn culture wars, is sort of two things. One, that I've never, when we moved into our house about 12 years ago now, we didn't have a lawnmower, so we went out and bought a lawnmower, and it was like the cheapest one they sold at Kmart. And I'm telling you, it still works great. After year 11, I asked, and this is honest to God how naive I am about these things, but I was talking to an old boss of mine, and every year he would talk about his sort of ritual every spring was to bring the mower in and get it serviced and all this stuff. And I was like, well, why do people do that? I don't know. And then I asked him once, I said, so what do they do when they service the lawnmower? And he listed off a couple of things, sharpen the blade, maybe check the spark plugs, and they also change the oil. And my response was, oh, you're supposed to do that? And he said, well, if they don't, you probably should. So after 11 years of having the cheapest mower I could find at Kmart, I did bring it into the local hardware store, and they did service it and change the oil out. And it's still running fine, by the way.
Yeah.
But
the main thing is to make sure it doesn't run out of oil. So
I had never checked it. I don't even know where the oil goes. I'm sure there's only limited spots, but I don't even. So I guess I was lucky. But someday this mower will stop being a mower, especially the way I've maybe mistreated it. And I am as certain as I can be that our next mower will be an electric mower. And have you ever used one? I've only heard such good things about them.
Yeah, our regular gas mower bit the dust last year after, I don't know, like 15 years or something.
I bet you even checked the oil too.
Yeah, I did check the oil. That was not the issue, but there's some more serious problems with it. We also did not get it serviced, but I always drained it of gas and that sort of thing. But we bought an electric mower last year, and we love it.
I've heard such good things, and I will admit that I'm not going to send my gas-powered mower to an early grave just so I can get an electric mower, although maybe some people would say that would be better for the environment. But yeah, I would be, and we'll link to this story in the show notes, but I mean, there's even states who are pretty quickly here banning the sale of gas-powered mowers pretty quickly. And I mean, does that seem like the right thing in your mind to do?
I don't like those kinds of bans. Think it's going to, I mean, there's so many reasons to prefer an electric mower because you don't have, you know, you don't have to worry about bad gas fouling the carburetor.
Don't have to worry about checking the oil. It's quieter.
Quieter, that's a big thing. And I think it really does bother me, like on a Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, and I like to read the paper on our porch and the neighbor starts mowing their lawn and it's really loud and you can't have a conversation, or in the evening, you know, to sit and somebody's mowing their lawn. And if it's a really, you know, so many gas mowers are very loud and suddenly, like if you're trying to listen to the radio or have a conversation with somebody, you can't, you have to go inside because.
So what is too early on the weekend or any day, I guess, to mow the yard?
I think before 9 o'clock in the mornings.
I think I've broken that rule a few times.
Unless you have an electric lawnmower.
I'm
not sure in the evening, but I'm just conscious of that. Like if people are not out and about, if there isn't a lot of road noise and other things, I don't want to be disturbing people's quiet with a lawnmower. This is something that I think Germany bans any loud machines on Sundays.
Really?
I remember,
but you're talking like, you know, things like...
I think lawnmowers and leaf blowers and other things that make a lot of noise so that it's quiet one day a week. And I really like that idea.
Well, now you've stumbled across another culture war landmine is leaf blowers. What is your... There are some people who think those things should be banned from the face of the earth.
Yeah, I don't think banning them, but they are very loud. I think you should be sensitive about when you use them,
and
you shouldn't be blowing all your leaves into your neighbor's yard, especially when they're around to see it.
So I'm going to make a confession here in front of you and anyone listening. Is I was very anti leaf blower for all those reasons, and now we have a leaf blower.
Electric or gas?
It is electric, so I feel that way made me feel okay. And it's, I guess I don't typically endorse products on this podcast. I don't do that very often. But if you need a leaf blower, that Milwaukee leaf blower, my goodness, that has some power, and it's pretty quiet. And it comes in handy from time to time. Even blowing out the garage in the spring when you're trying to get all the soot and salt out of the garage, it's kind of gonna be a handy thing.
I think they're great tools.
Yeah.
Now, there was my wife and I for 9 summers, we operated a mini golf course in Colorado. The leaf blower was an essential piece of equipment. And back then, they were backpack blowers.
They were gas operated, right?
Gas operated. They were pretty heavy. So you put it on, you had two straps, like a big backpack. And then the
ear protection.
And ear protection. They were super loud. Of course, we were in a commercial area, so it wasn't that big a deal. There was a lot of traffic on the road and things like that. But we'd blow off all the holes. We had 18 of them, all the carpet,
all the windmills,
through the windmill. That would make it spin around. And we did that several times a day. Just constantly. And I got really used to using one. But I would never want to use one like that in a residential area. And this is the thing with the lawn service companies, that's what they use. They come in with these really big commercial leaf blowers, and it's very loud. And there's some that get used in our neighborhood, and you can hear it from a block away. And I just think it's kind of insensitive to neighbors to do that, because we have a short period of time in the summer, when it's really pleasant to be outside, and I think noise pollution is a real thing. I'm not sure about banning them, but I do think it's perhaps insensitive to use them.
I want to, before we close, go back to something we sort of started talking about at the beginning, and I'll start off by quoting a woman named Emma Criss, who works for an environmental group called Green America, and this was in a story we'll link to from Axios. And she says, and I quote, "The more conservative someone is, the more staunchly they hold the belief that they need to hold a perfectly manicured green lawn." And I guess I don't know if that's true. I don't know how much Emma Criss has looked into this, if there have been studies that correlate lawn care practices with political affiliation. But even if there were, I'm sure it's not 100-0. And I guess my instinctual reaction to that is we just don't need more things in this country that drive us apart. And yes, you might be a Democrat, and yes, your lawn might be a little scraggly, and yes, your neighbor next door might have this perfectly manicured lawn that Emma Criss denounces in this quote, but to then make the leap and say, so therefore, that neighbor is a MAGA Trump supporter, and because I'm a Democrat, I don't want to interact with that neighbor, I think is saying all the wrong things about where we are in society today.
Yeah, these kinds of claims go overboard. So there is a correlation between your political views and certain characteristics that are on the Big Five personality test. You know, so like openness is highly correlated with being liberal and voting Democrat. And if you score low on openness, which you tend to have more of a preference for orderliness and for boundaries and things that kind of have a more predictable kind of shape or structure to them. Whereas if you score higher on openness, you're more open to new ideas, trying new things, but you're more kind of tolerant of chaos and kind of new creative ways of doing things. So you can see why there ends up being a political preference for like really nicely manicured traditional types of lawns. And there would be a correlation that if there's a correlation to openness and that sort of aesthetic preference, and that correlates then to political views, yeah, there's going to be a link between people who prefer the manicured lawns and vote Republican. But that's a correlation that's like doesn't say anything about what you really believe politically. It's just a matter of aesthetic taste, right? And there's can be lots of reasons why you may be liberal or conservative about all kinds of economic policies or social policies and things that don't really correspond to your aesthetic taste, right? And so that's why I think these are kind of overblown sometimes. And, you know, if you have you have neighbors who are both artists and they have a sculpture and different things, it's very likely they also have, you know, all kinds of shrubbery and, you know, and a long grass and a no mow may sign in their yard. I mean, yeah, there's those kinds of correlations.
But you aren't worried that these type of things, which we've talked about a number of times on the show, that what this country seems to be lacking more and more all the time are these personal relationships between real people in real places and not electronic. And I just worry that we build up these reasons to not like people based on sort of tertiary attributes about them, and that many people find it difficult to overlook things like that when they should just get to know the person and not worry so much about how often the leaf blower might be running.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that goes back to your initial question.
Yes.
Yeah, don't make judgments about people's character based on how they care for their lawn. And because a much better way to judge a person's character is actually get to know them. And you might find out that they're a lot more interesting and virtuous than you are.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
I've got a yard question, Scott. Let's say that you have a backyard that adjoins your neighbor's yards on both sides, and there's no fences or obstructions between them, so it makes a large open space. Your neighbors have kids who frequently play games like soccer or touch football or other things, so they're back running back and forth among these three yards. But this means you often have soccer balls or footballs, or depending on the time of the year, you have things that are flying into your flower garden, onto your patio, and you've talked to the neighbors about just being more careful, but that hasn't stopped because these are kids and they run bunches.
Yeah.
But you're tired of the destruction of your flower garden and knocking things over on the patio. Is there any reason for you not to just say, okay, I'm putting up a fence and kind of protecting my yard?
So I'll say two things that'll make me remarkably unpopular. I am not the world's biggest fan of dogs, and I'm not the world's biggest fan of young children. But the difference is I've never been a dog. I have been a kid. Mm-hmm. And I remember a couple, we moved around a little bit as a kid, but I can remember two places we lived that when you were talking about that, I could picture two yard scenarios that we had that as a kid, I took full advantage of. And I don't remember kicking a ball and knocking over the neighbor's geranium pot, but, you know, I may have. But I just remember so many fun, good memories around that time as a kid that I would really, I mean, if it truly appeared to be, and from your description, I think it is, just innocent mistakes, I would really hesitate to do anything to put an end to that because the strong likelihood is this only lasts for, you know, you don't have 17-year-olds doing this. And nor do you have, you know, 7 months old doing this. It's a finite period of time. And I really would try to remember what it was like when I was a kid and enjoyed that same freedom. And I'm also a very firm, even though I don't have kids and maybe, again, not the world's biggest fan of kids, I truly believe that having kids get outside and hang out with their friends and exercise and is all the things that kids should be doing more of than they probably are. So I would worry to do anything to discourage that would make me a bad person. Now, however, if you would have said this was a dog next door, that would have been a whole different – that to me would be very different. I would have had much less patience for a dog coming over and doing sometimes what dogs do in people's yards or tearing up the flower bed. And that I would have been – maybe I would have considered a fence or maybe I would have had a more – direct conversation with the neighbor. I'm not sure, but I would certainly differ. I would put those into two very distinct categories.
So if it's a dog that's occasionally coming over and causing some damage, like digging a hole occasionally or, you know, depositing something in your yard, but the neighbor's really apologetic and comes over and tries to fix it or make you're fine with
then
it.
Then I'm fine with that. Yeah. Obviously, dogs are dogs, and they do what they do. And you know, and it's really the owners that have to bear that responsibility. And if they, you know, take ownership of the problem and try to do what's best, then I'm fine with it. And I've never had a real bad experience with this. But if there was a situation where the dog was constantly coming over and just being a huge nuisance, and you know, dogs can be sometimes more than a nuisance. They can be, you know, sometimes some dogs can be dangerous in rare occasions. So I mean, all those things. I would be much less forgiving about that than the scenario you outline.
I lived in a house for 1 year in Grand Rapids, Michigan that had, it was a row of houses and all the backyards were adjoined like that. There were no fences for the whole block, which is really rare right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I noticed something. We were just there for a year, but I noticed that you know, a few of the homes had little kids, and they had this great freedom because there was almost like this huge private park in the back that they could go. And neighbors interacted with one another in the back because they would walk, you know, from one house and maybe across a couple of people's lawn to the other. But it was like this great common, this shared space, which really increased the neighborliness and the interaction of everybody on that block. And they all seemed to get along really well. And I thought, wow, that made that a really great neighborhood because then after that, we moved to Memphis and we were in many ways, a similar kind of neighborhood, but every single house had fences. And it made the place we were living seem so much smaller. Like we had our own little space, but it seemed like we were really cramped in a way that the place in Grand Rapids seemed expansive, and I really wish, like, if everybody had gotten rid of their fences, it would have been such a much nicer, hospitable place to live.
Well, and certainly I think this is kind of common knowledge, but if you look at, you know, architecture over the past 100 years or so, you know, older homes, and I think yours is a great example of this, you know, the primary outdoor sitting space is out front, right? You have a big sort of a porch that kind of L's around two sides of your house. If that house were built today, very likely that rec space or that set out space, whether a deck or a patio, is almost always in the backyard because people like the privacy. And then you can have a fence, and then your fence can be 6 feet tall so then you don't see your neighbor. And And it is sort of the privatization, if you will, of our home lives, and trying to also, for what reasons I don't always understand, keeping your neighbors at bay. And yeah, I agree. I don't think overall that's a tremendously healthy trend. And it's certainly a long trend, however.
Yeah. Just looking around our own city of La Crosse, I would, you know, like in the main town area, I think most homes have fences, don't they?
Yeah, and I think going back to, I think a lot of it has to do with dogs. I think if you have a dog, you do like to let it out and roam around, and even if your dog is it a dog forever and you don't have a dog, but I mean, you're not going to take the fence down, and sometimes that actually helps resale value. So I think that's probably the driver to that. I'll tell you too, when I've spent time in the American Southwest, where the summers are much longer and certainly much hotter. And there, of course, everybody has a pool. And for reasons we all know, you have to have a wall around the pool. And then that really, I'm sure you've noticed this, flying over some of, you know, whether it's Phoenix or something, and you see these dotted blue backyards with pools in them with all these high cement walls around them. And you're just like, gosh, that's... You know, I guess you could look at it positively, everybody's little private oasis, but it's also like everybody's little private compound.
Yeah, yeah. You end up feeling, well, fenced in, not like you're, I guess the intent is to fence others out, but.
Yeah, yeah. I don't spend much time on these channels, but there's even like entire TV shows about how you can make your backyard seem like private and, you know, kind of the extension of your house and make it feel like it's private space. And again, I understand the appeal to some of that, but I also think we could maybe spend a little more time thinking about how we can be part of our community and maybe not sequester ourselves from the community.
I'd love to go back to that neighborhood in Grand Rapids and see if it's still the same, if it's still open in that way. I would be kind of surprised if it is.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, like, it would only take one person to put up, you know, a single fence to destroy the whole thing, because it required the collaboration of everybody not to put up fences to have that great openness and common space, which I think kind of made people feel better about living there. But it would really surprise me if that's still the case.
Well, when people have to road trip to Grant, would you be able to find the block?
Yes. So you're going to be driving around Lake Michigan.
Lake Michigan, yeah. Will that take me through Grand Rapids?
Pretty close.
Okay.
So we can give you the block and you can go.
I'll do a live report from the Rick's old backyard. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.